The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this episode, we'll dig a little deeper into the December issue of Our State Magazine, featuring articles inspired by familiar Christmas carols. The first article is entitled, I Saw Three Ships Come Sailing In. More than 50 years after the last residents of Portsmouth Island moved away, a descendant of the once busy shipping village decks the halls in their honor. And there's a photograph of the church, the crown jewel of Portsmouth Island is its Methodist church, built around 1914. Services were discontinued in 1956, but the church often opens to the public, and it's festooned with greenery, as exterior picture, festooned with greenery and wreaths on the front door. And the siding is white, but then there's green tiles on the roof of the steeple and the church itself. It's 20 days before Christmas, and Gregory Gilko stuffs the last of about two dozen wreaths into the hold of his boat. The night before, the temperatures bottomed out in the 20s, and in the early morning light, ice clung in a thin sheet around the oyster beds along the shore of Cedar Island. Tucking a red bow into the compartment, Gilko is ready to go home to a place he's never lived, to decorate an island village where no living soul remains. He's returning to Portsmouth, one of the largest settlements along North Carolina's string of Outer Banks, where now only sacred memories and about 25 structures remain. Although few, if any, folks will ever see the decorations, the village will be trimmed for Christmas thanks to Gilgo's dedication and the support of Friends of Portsmouth Island, a group devoted to preserving the history of this place. Gilgo's gloved hand pushes off the dock, and he heads toward Pamlico Sound, zipping his camouflage jacket all the way up and cinching the hood tightly over his toboggan, leaving only his cheeks exposed. The sun hangs at a 30-degree angle, casting a cone of diamonds across the water, leading Gilgo to his destination 45 minutes north and east. It's the kind of bitter cold that cuts through layers, paralyzing the face and stiffening fingertips until the painful sensation of pins and needles fades into a dull numbness. The occasional spray of salt water pellets his jacket, freezing into tiny drops where they land. Speeding through a maze of pound nets and duck blinds, the banks hover like a mirage in the distance. Once, these waters would have teemed with wooden boats coming and going, their masts silhouetted against the bright blue sky. But this morning, Gilgo is the lone boat, welcomed only by two porpoises breaking the surface as the church steeple in the heart of Portsmouth Village comes into sight. Chartered by the legislature in 1753 as a port to serve the growing royal colony, Portsmouth Village, on the southern side of Ocracoke Inlet, was once the epicenter of maritime trade in North Carolina. The primary access point to Pamlico Sound, Ocracoke Inlet was the critical conduit through which ships and goods reached settlements like New Bern, Bath, and Washington. As a vital link in the state's economy, Portsmouth flourished. By the turn of the 19th century, it was the largest community on the Outer Banks, with a population of more than 200 and a federal customs house to oversee commerce. The nature of Pamlico Sound created a thriving lightering industry. The shallow water prevented large cargo ships from navigating beyond a certain point, so small boats would go and transfer cargo from bigger ships and transport the goods to inland seaports. Growth continued through the first half of the century, and by the early 1840s, two-thirds of the state's exports exited through Ocracoke Inlet. As trade swelled, so did Portsmouth's population, peaking at 685 residents in 1860, most connected to the town's shipping industry. The village was so significant to maritime trade and national defense that in 1842, Congress appropriated money for a hospital at Portsmouth to care for sick mariners. It was the first building in the state constructed as a dedicated hospital. But the same geography that gave prosperity to Portsmouth would be its ultimate demise. Shoaling had begun to choke the inlet, and in 1846, a hurricane carved a new, deeper Hatteras outlet to the north. As trade routes began shifting, the era of Portsmouth's maritime reign was ending. Gilgo loops the boat bow line several times around the dock's piling and pulls it taut. He unloads the wreaths, tossing them onto the concrete dock, littered with fragments of clamshells discarded by hungry gulls. With the sun higher, temperatures have climbed. He sheds his outermost layer and, wreaths in tow, sets off into the quiet village, now part of the Cape Lookout National Seashore. In the desolation of winter, there are no rangers, no tourists, only the sounds of birds and a light wind. The imprints of Gilgo's extra-tough boots join the tracks of raccoons who've long retreated in the morning light. Summer's bright green marsh has turned brown and rigid, and the mosquitoes and no-see-ums that typically swarm thick are gone. His shadow follows behind him on the trail, and sand fiddlers rush to their chimneys, disappearing into the mud. It's low tide, and oyster beds punctuate the silence as they snap shut in succession. Yellow-rumped warblers join the percussion with their polite tat-a-tats, flitting among blades of needlerush. Gilgo passes the small white post office and crosses over Doctor's Creek. He bypasses the village's landmark icon, the Methodist Church, with his attention fixed on a small gray home a little ways up. There's a reverence and deep pride in his step that can only be born into a person. He crosses the yard and climbs the two wooden steps up to the porch of the board and batten cottage where his grandparents, Lionel and Emma Gilgo, once lived. The Gilgos called Portsmouth home for generations, but the local school closed in the early 1940s. So when their oldest son was ready to start school, they were forced to move to the mainland. Gilgo holds a wreath up to the door and steps back as far as his arms allow. Satisfied, he grabs the nail he's been holding between his teeth and hammers the wreath into place. Once it's secure, he adds a bow tied by his 79-year-old mother. He adjusts it till it sits just right. Soon the wind will have its way, but for this moment, the wreath is picture perfect. Taking in the place where his uncle first celebrated Christmas morning, he backs off the porch and sets off across the village. As the face of the hammer finds the head of a nail, the ring reverberates across the marsh, its pitch changing as the nail's shank sinks into the wood. Tap, tap, thud. I notice that the hammer has missed its mark. Crisscrosses the village as Gilgo works his way from house to house toward the easternmost edge of the community. By the 1880s, shipping routes through Ocracoke Inlet had vanished, and Portsmouth's population declined as livelihoods disappeared. But those who stayed still depended on the waters around them, and boats remained their salvation. They traded shipping jobs for commercial fishing, and in 1894 they received a lifeline, a U.S. life-saving service station. Erected to aid shipwrecked mariners, the largest building in the village holds countless maritime stories, some tragic, some fortunate, all heroic. Among them was the 1903 rescue of the Vera Cruz 7, in which 421 victims were saved from peril. To date, it remains the largest rescue from a single vessel in North Carolina's history. The life-saving service provided reliable employment, served a vital role in the community, and in its ultimate purpose, saved countless lives. But it could not save the community itself. By 1940, with the station decommissioned and shipping gone, only 42 permanent residents remained. Among them were Gilgo's grandparents. After hanging the final wreath on the life-saving station, Gilgo still has the village's crown jewel, the Methodist Church, left to decorate. He heads east, following the hollow roar of the ocean along the grove of cedars and yaupon separating the village from the Atlantic. He passes a path leading to the graves of two sea captains from the early 1800s, and climbs into the edge of the brush, past prickly pears and sand spurs, in search of tender cedar boughs. Piece by piece, he selects young shoots, their fresh growth tinged with chartreuse, tucking them under his arm as he goes. When he can fit no more, he turns back toward the village, the steeple his guide, a piney scent tinging the salt air in his wake. On the steps of the church, the center of spiritual and community life, Gilgo assembles boughs of greenery for the windowsills and altar. He opens the double doors leading into the vestibule and steps inside the 1915 building, where the floors tilt slightly to the right, a lasting reminder of a hurricane that shifted the foundation 80 years prior. The quiet loneliness of the village is amplified here. In the shelter of the sanctuary, Gilgo goes about completing his work, carrying on a tradition started many years ago by Pat Austin and Chester Lynn of Ocracoke, both steadfast guardians of Portsmouth Island history and heritage. He decks the piano with faux poinsettia stems, adorns the wall behind the pulpit with wreaths, and lines the altar rail with freshly tied boughs. Now, as the late afternoon sun shines through the starburst patterned glass windows, a warm light spills across the old wooden pews, creating sharply angled shadows that complement the dramatic diagonal pattern of the tongue and groove walls. The faint scent of crisp cedar bleeds from the altar to the vestibule. Finished, he assesses his work, standing in the stillness with dust motes suspended in the surrounding light. His father, a carpenter and commercial fisherman who worshipped during homecomings in the same church, passed away about 6 months prior. In this moment, the loss deepens Gilgo's connection to this place and the meaning of the Christmas season. Satisfied with the job, he turns to leave, his work now done. He may be one of only a handful of people who will ever see these decorations, and that's enough. The last two residents of Portsmouth Village left in 1971, marking a new chapter in the sacred place's history that spans more than two centuries and today lives on only in the hearts and minds of those connected to these shifting sands. As Gilgo returns to the dock, following the same path as the two women who left some 50 years prior, the wind has died down and the water is slick calm, reflecting golden light. In the quiet, you can hear the sandy dirt settling beneath your shoes, and if you listen closely, the sounds of generations of islanders celebrating the Christmas season. Our next article is entitled The Holly and the Ivy. Once left to the weeds, a world-class holly collection in Pinehurst is thriving again, thanks to the determination of those who believe in a second season. Hollies can be prickly, a guaranteed ouch for gardeners' bare hands. Their berries are somewhat toxic, their branches unwieldy. If you've ever tried to move one, impossible might be the word that comes to mind. Even from a stump, ground level, to the earth, jabbing shoots arise. Still, when the world feels cold and tired, all grays, browns, and whites, we deck our halls with holly's festive deep green boughs. For many of us, the pointy evergreen leaves and bright red berries symbolize life and resilience. This was a time of year in the 1920s when young Fred Ebersole, growing up in western North Dakota, gazed out at a drifting snow collecting on a hardy English holly. If ever I grow up to have a garden of my own, I'm going to plant it with this kind of God's plant, Ebersole wrote. Ebersole didn't become a horticulturist, he became a chemist. Even so, plants, especially hollies, remained his quiet passion. Ebersole had a successful career that took him all over the country, says Lee Bunch, executive director of the Sandhills Horticultural Gardens. After Ebersole retired to the Pinehurst area in 1968, he'd expanded his botanical collection to more than 300 cultivars. Ebersole's childhood dream came to fruition at the Sand Hills Horticultural Gardens, a public garden tucked in next to Sand Hills Community College. Like the leaves on his beloved holly, Ebersole's dream contained a few pricks and snags, and, also like the holly, it persisted. The first time Bunch saw the Ebersole holly garden, he was a landscaping student at Sand Hills Community College. That was in 1995, and by then it had already gained international status as one of the world's largest and most impressive collections, he says. To Bunch and the other students, Ebersold was a local legend. In the 1970s and early 1980s, when Ebersold's health was declining and he had to sell his house, he gave his collection to the college, Bunch says. It took 3 years for the landscaping students to transplant them. In the Ebersold Holly Garden, manicured grass pathways once connected collections of English, Japanese, Chinese, and American hollies. A star-shaped gazebo overlooked a pond that anchored the gardens. From its peaceful reflection perch, visitors back then stood in awe at the collection ranging from small to gigantic, evergreen to deciduous. The garden's curator, Pat Joseph, was always in the garden. She would tag each plant and show us what she thought was cool, Bunch recounts. Holly berries here aren't just the expected red. For example, in winter, plants reveal burgundy, magenta, yellow, cream, orange, and even blackberries. Their leaves aren't always bright green and spiky. Some are more gentle, variegated, or smooth. Not only did Joseph label each holly for the public, she also presented cuttings to the Holly Society of America. She was in constant contact with different professors and curators across the country, Bunch says. The Ebersold Holly Garden was so impressive that it paved the way for new, lush spaces at the Sandhills Horticultural Gardens, the Sir Walter Raleigh Garden, over an acre of formal English plantings, the Hillside Garden, and the Desmond Native Wetland Trail Garden. After Joseph left in the early 2000s, the position went unfilled. 2 decades later, when Bunch returned, he found one side of the garden covered in weeds and vines. The surrounding wetland had encroached into the garden, and many of the labels Joseph had painstakingly applied to each plant had fallen away. No one's to blame, Bunch says. It was only the product of a forgotten dream. Bunch remembered, though. He wanted everyone else to remember as well. Most that people think they can identify a holly. You imagine that evergreen, Christmas tree-shaped bush at the corner of your house, Bunch says. To expand that notion, he takes visitors over to one of his favorite spots in the Ebersold Holly Garden, a section filled with massive trees, some boasting 40-foot-tall canopies. Bunch encourages them to look up. These huge, beautiful hollies have gray and white bark, different from any other trees, a stark contrast to our native pines, he says. To get underneath them is a different experience than looking straight onto the holly bush in your yard. Bunch points out one of the students' favorite selfie spots, a picture frame shape formed by branches that stretched and twisted together over the years. This one over there is called a peach leaf holly because its leaves look like peach tree leaves, he says, showing visitors another of his favorites. Look at those leaves, Bunch says, pulling down a low-hanging branch of another tree so a disbeliever can touch its leaves, about as long as a man's hand. They're massive because this tree is just that old. But look, there are no spines. It's very smooth. Ebersold's Holly Garden, grand old holly trees witness the garden's past glory, and they give Bunch hope for the future. This is holly, remember? Holly lovers know all about resilience and renewal. Along with Sandhills Community College's landscaping students and a team of local volunteers, Bunch is restoring and rejuvenating the garden's collection. Some of the hollies are nearly a century old, and even under the best conditions, they won't live forever. There are so many new holly varieties that I'd love to bring to our garden and set among the older, mature hollies. They will have a legacy growing among the new hollies that arrive. Bunch wants the next generation of holly enthusiasts to walk among the hollies and, like Ebersold, dream of possibilities for their own gardens. I hope they'll come to the garden to see, genetically, where these new varieties come from and take cuttings, Bunch says. For years, visitors have admired azaleas in spring and breathed in tea olives in summer, unaware that nearby, a year-round dream awaited. Now they see it for themselves, proof that hollies and the dreams of those who love them can be stubborn and resilient. And if you'd like to visit, the garden is located at Sand Hills Community College on Airport Road in Pinehurst. And you can look up more information on the Our State website at ourstate.com/holly-garden. Our next article is entitled, Oh, Christmas Tree. One of Avery County's oldest tree farms extends its evergreen branches to those who fight for our freedom, a sacrifice its founder understood well. And the photo is of Cartner's Christmas Tree Farm in Newland, which owes its decades of success to the High Country's ideal growing conditions and the passion of its founder, veteran Sam Cartner. And from the picture in the foreground, you see some of the tops of trees, and then in the midground is just tree after tree after tree, thousands of trees. And in the background, you see the mountains and a big barn, but just thousands of trees, just in a glance there. Come the first Friday in December, a joyful noise rises from the blustery shores of Smith Lake at Fort Bragg. Christmas carols greet the families of troops from North Carolina's biggest Army base as they drive up. Just ahead, volunteers, some wearing Santa hats with their camouflage fatigues, await the crowd. Between bites of duck donuts and sips of coffee, the troops leap into action and tie Christmas trees to car roofs and truck beds. Each one is a gift from Trees for Troops, a program by the nonprofit National Christmas Spirit Foundation that donates American-grown Christmas trees to military facilities across the country. We see a lot of grateful faces and smiles, says James Day, Fort Bragg's chief of outdoor recreation, who's helped to coordinate the base's involvement with the program since 2013. And it's on both ends, the families and kids getting the trees and the soldiers helping out and giving back. But North Carolina isn't simply on the receiving end of the Christmas spirit. For the past several years, the state has been one of the top five biggest contributors to Trees for Troops. The roots of that generosity, along with the whole Tar Heel tree industry that makes it possible, were planted by one farmer more than 200 miles away in Avery County. Sam Cartner founded Cartner's Christmas Tree Farm in 1959 as a 39-year-old World War II veteran. He rarely spoke of his own military connections. While he served as a B-24 tail gunner in the Pacific Theater, he lived by the Christmas ideals of peace on earth and goodwill toward men. He said, if the people who made the decision to go to war had to fight in the war, we've gotten in a lot fewer wars, recalls his son Jim. Understanding the sacrifices they made, Sam believed in supporting the troops. And when the National Christmas Tree Association reached out in 2005 looking for contributions to the first year of Trees for Troops, he knew he could share a bit of holiday joy with them. Since then, the farm has donated many of its own Fraser firs to bases across the U.S. and coordinated donations from other farms in western North Carolina. Sam died in 2017. At 97, he was one of the oldest veterans in Avery County. Jim and his brother, David, brothers David and Sam, have carried forward the tradition their father started. We've always felt like it was a worthy cause to help our service people that have done so much for us to make our country great, says the younger Sam. That commitment held strong, even last year as Western North Carolina wrestled with the impacts of Hurricane Helene. Despite the washed-out roads and damaged fields, the Cartners alone lost nearly 6,000 trees, about 10% of that year's planting. North Carolina still contributed more than 960 trees to military families, nearly double the amount that Trees for Troops had estimated before the storm. Rick Dungy, executive director of the Christmas Spirit Foundation, said he didn't expect any donations from the state in the wake of Helene. I almost came to tears, he recalls, on learning of what the Cartners and other growers put together for military families. The dedication and the commitment that those folks have to make this program happen is just inspiring. The elder Cartner started growing trees in the spirit of generosity. Sam had grown up in Moxville but came to Avery County as an agricultural extension agent after the war to help local farmers. At the time, many mountaineers battled a short growing season to eke out a living with annual crops like beans and cabbage. He soon realized that if the native Fraser fir, if marketed and sold as a Christmas tree, could bring those farmers an economic boon. Compared to other conifers, it holds onto its needles longer, has sturdier branches for hanging ornaments, and exudes an unmistakable scent. But despite these advantages, customers mostly ignored the tree in favor of the Scotch pine and other species. Sam decided to set an example himself and established the largest Fraser fir plantation east of the Mississippi River in 1959. He devoted himself to advising farmers and helping organize the North Carolina Christmas Tree Association to advocate for their new crop. Through Sam's steady, persistent, and relationship building, the Fraser fir became a success. North Carolina is one of the top Christmas tree producers in the country, harvesting more than 3.2 million trees in 2022. In the weeks after Christmas, the rolling Blue Ridge slopes of the Kartner farm will lie at rest under a quilt of snow, like an overstuffed relative dozing on the couch after too much fruitcake. A quiet wind will rustle the soft, stubby needles of the Fraser firs that fill the blanket's blocks with green. Dirt access roots run across the hillsides, ruddy threads stitching together the tidy plots of trees. The hills won't be sleeping for long. Soon, workers will clear space for new trees, each transplanted onto the farm's roughly 400 acres as a tiny seedling. The spring, summer, and fall will pass in a flurry of fertilizer, pest control, and trimming to keep trees healthy and coax them into the perfect conical shape. And then will come the riotous run-up to Christmas itself, when the fragrant harvest fills tractor trailers that carry tens of thousands of 4 to 8 foot firs to garden centers as far-flung as Utah. As in years before, they'll set 20 or so aside, ready to ship out across the nation with trees for troops. Although the three younger Kartners now live away from the property, Sam is a veterinarian and splits his time between North Carolina and Alabama, while David is a lawyer in Asheville and Jim's a veterinarian in Statesville. They continue to run the business and gather at their childhood home in Newland, now the farm office. Between plans for the next holiday rush, they reminisce about boyhood sleigh rides down the long hill beside the house, their dad pulling them to the top with his tractor after each run. Beyond his farm, the sons say their father's real passion was giving back to those around him. One of his many accolades, Sam's most cherished, was being named Avery County Citizen of the Century in 2011 in recognition of the benefits Christmas trees had brought to the region. He would be so proud that the Fraser fir species has provided so much income and supported so many families, he said of his father's work as a county agricultural agent. He educated more kids, built more houses, and helped more vehicles get bought in this county than anyone. And it was all because of this, David says, gesturing to a snow-covered field of young firs outside the office window. Their emerald branches stand proud and strong, ready to support not just lights and baubles, but a family's legacy of service. Kartner's Christmas Tree Farm is located at 901 Balsam Drive in Newland, North Carolina. And you can check out their website, carolinafraserfir.com. Well, that sound means we've run out of time for today's episode of For Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. And this broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. So long till next time.